What are we going to talk about today?
Well, last time I was on, I was talking about religion and politics. And as usual, I brought way too much material for the show, right, because we want to get to callers eventually, right? And my last sort of little topic was about this, what belies or what's underneath this religion and politics. And I thought it was an interesting enough topic to make a whole show out of it. So once again, I have way too much material on an even more specific topic. But hopefully it'll be interesting for folks. And this is the topic of authoritarianism. And most people don't even know what the heck that is. And I didn't until fairly recently myself. One definition says authoritarianism describes a form of social control characterized by strict obedience to the authority of a state or organization, often maintaining and enforcing control through the use of oppressive measures. Authoritarian regimes are strongly hierarchical. Okay, so this kind of describes some of the governments that perhaps we don't necessarily like monarchies and dictatorships and despotisms and even theocracies are largely authoritarian. Democracies tend not to be authoritarian. They tend to be kind of the opposite. Egalitarian is kind of the antonym. But you can have a political regime that's kind of midway between, right, if most of the citizens of authoritarian states don't perceive their state as authoritarian until late into its development. And this makes it difficult to label modern states as democratic or authoritarian. So it's a little bit, difficult to piece this all together. Now, what I really wanted to focus on, instead of, regimes and politics and the way different government structures are, I really wanted to focus more on the personalities that make this thing happen. And there is a thing called an authoritarian personality. And in a sense, authoritarianism begins at home. And if we can switch to the slides, guys, this is, you actually can be brought up in an authoritarian family structure and actually sort of get by just being raised in this family structure, a kind of a bootstrapping into this sort of authoritarian personality. And in this authoritarian personality structure, you can see it's hierarchical. The father is above the mother, who's above the child, right? And the father more or less makes all the decisions. He's the supreme commander over the mother, who is responsible for the children. The father makes decisions, the mother is subservient. Now, you can contrast that with an egalitarian family structure where the father and the mother kind of have equal roles, right? They are partners. The parents make decisions through dialogue, and both parents help with the children. Now, all families kind of are somewhere in between these two things. These are sort of caricatures, right? If you look back on your family, the father may have made many of the decisions, or there may have been certain roles that the father fulfilled and the mother fulfilled other roles. So there's lots of shades of gray here.
Although, from the point of view of the child, they're still in an authoritarian.
Right. Well, they have two masters instead of one. But you can say that makes an important distinction, right? Because children in an egalitarian household, even though they have two parents, they see that these parents arrive at decisions through dialogue and that each of them is right sometimes, right? It's not one parent ordering the other by fiat or by, this is, I think, the really heart of it, that in an egalitarian household, children learn to make up their own minds because they see the parents have a dialogue. And no one parent's always right, and so they have to learn to determine right and wrong for themselves. But in an authoritarian household, all they have to do is obey. So they really don't have to learn. They don't learn this. So this is I think one of the big things is this family structure has a big impact. So what are some of the implications for children? Well, in an authoritarian household, these children don't necessarily learn how to negotiate, and they don't learn how to make decisions based on reason necessarily. They tend to learn more that might makes right, right? That the big guy makes the decisions and whatever he says goes, right? There's a strong gender roles in authoritarian families and less flexibility. Think of also in an authoritarian household, how many children might there be? Well, if the father's making decisions and the mama can't say no, she's just a girl who can't say no, they're probably going to have more children, right? So there's going to be more children. There's going to be potentially fewer resources for those children, right? Because if there's more children, there's, you know, and the mother has the sole responsibility for taking care of those children, those children may also be less more likely to be poor and more likely to miss out on some educational opportunities than a smaller family would. So these are all just sort of trends and subtle distinctions. So what happens out of this now when we have this authoritarian upbringing? We end up with people who end up with an authoritarian personality, and there's actually a guy by the name of Bob Altmaier, also known as Robert Altmaier. He goes by both first names, and he's kind of the main researcher right now in this area, and not without some controversy. He has developed a scale or kind of a personality test. Actually, it's more of an attitude test, right? We're not talking about how someone really is. It's just their attitudes at the particular time. And his test is called the right-wing authoritarianism test, or RWA, and it measures a convergence of three things. It measures how likely are you to submit to authority, so a high degree of submission to the authorities who are perceived to be established and legitimate in the society in which one lives. Here's a quote: it's good to have a strong authoritarian leader, or it's good to have a strong leader. The next thing is aggression to outsiders, outgroups, in general aggressiveness directed at various persons that are perceived to be sanctioned by the established authorities. So you play attack dog. That's the second thing. And then the third trait is conventionalism, or a high degree of adherence to social conventions that are perceived to be endorsed by society and its established authorities. These three things tend to travel together, and people tend to score very highly on these three things, or they tend to score very low on these four things on this scale. And so there's a lot of interesting. This work builds on an earlier work done in the 50s based on a book called The Authoritarian Personality. A guy named Adorno and a bunch of other folks developed this work earlier, and they were studying fascism because basically in the 50s we were looking back at World War II and looking back at Hitler and saying, what happened? What went wrong? How did this happen, and how can we prevent it? And so these earlier folks developed a thing called an F scale, or a scale for fascist tendencies, which includes some of these things that in this right wing authoritarianism. But this just focuses on a very narrow thing, and this scale has been tested in a lot of ways, and it's tuned up quite well, and the author Altmaier can back that up. Okay, so and I want to emphasize too that this is attitudes and not necessarily behavior, although this does have a lot of implications for how people you can use this right wing authoritarian test. People who score high on this tend to have certain things that are true about them, and people will be amazed at this list. They tend to have faulty reasoning, right? They tend to make incorrect inferences from evidence. They tend to hold contradictory ideas, leading them to speak out of both sides of their mouths. They uncritically accept insufficient evidence that supports their beliefs. We've seen this a lot with some of these religious leaders. Uncritically trust people who tell them what they want to hear. Make use of many double standards in their thinking and judgment. So that's faulty reasoning. They tend to be hostile to the outgroups, which is one of the things they're measuring. Right, they're willing to weaken the constitutional guarantees of liberty, such as in the Bill of Rights, because if they're an outgroup or a group that they don't like, they're happy to cut off those rights, and they are willing to severely punish common criminals in a role-playing situation, and they admit they get a personal pleasure from punishing such people. So this is the RWA's highs, as they're called. They tend to be prejudiced against racial, ethnic, nationalistic, and linguistic minorities. They tend to be hostile towards homosexuals. They are willing to volunteer to help the government persecute almost anyone. And they are maybe mean-spirited towards those who have made mistakes and suffered. So So that's hostility. There's a couple others here. Profound character attributes. They tend to be dogmatic, zealots, hypocrites, bullies when they have power. They seek dominance over others by being competitive and destructive in situations requiring cooperation. So that's no good. And they are also, finally, blind. They tend to be blind to one's own failings and the failings of authority figures for whom they respect. And this is key for later. So they believe they have no personal failings. They avoid learning about their personal failings, which would presumably help them overcome them over time, right? They might be highly self-righteous, or they might use religion to ease guilt over their acts and maintain their self-righteousness. So this is some of the implications of this sort of family structure, is that if you end up with this right-wing authoritarian personality in your later life, you're going to have these sort of, I would say they're flaws. I would say honestly that most of the things I just mentioned are really character flaws, and they can have a bad effect in the long run. So that's the right-wing authoritarian and personality. Now let's take a look at that and religion, right? So I would claim now that this right-wing authoritarianism both has an interesting relationship to religion, which we'll talk about next, and also has an interesting relationship to politics, right? And in a sense, it sort of intersects with the worst of both of those, right? So in religion, we have an authoritarian family structure is actually also very, very good for transmitting religion from the parents to the child. Generally, in an authoritarian family structure, you end up with the father more or less dictating the religion to the children and to the family. And you can actually see that in some of the Bible verses, like, let's see, I don't have it handy here, but we'll see that a little bit later. Children tend to get used to hierarchies and fiats and all this structure. They tend to be loyal to the family. They tend to be loyal to the religion. There's potentially less, in authoritarian families, there tends to be less education, less exposure to alternative views because you don't have this dialogue between the parents. It's a well-known thing that if the mother and the father are different religions, that the child tends to not have either one religion. Right, they tend to go off and make their own decision, and that's a very good example of this sort of thing, right? Where if you don't have this reinforcement, the child ends up making up their own mind, and it might be a very different result than what either parent has. So, the religion in this authoritarian regime ends up being the legitimate authority that people align themselves with. So. These authoritarian people tend to bow to religious authority. They're more willing to persecute outgroups like women and gays and other people of other religions. They're more likely to accept faulty reasoning when it supports their religion, and less likely to accept it when it doesn't support their religion. They are more likely to trust people who are untrustworthy, and we've certainly seen that with the priest scandal and Haggard and all these other folks, right? They tend to be self-righteous and hypocrites, which also plays into the religion thing, right? That you don't necessarily follow the religious creed yourself, but you beat up on somebody who does follow them or who doesn't follow them themselves. So, not surprisingly, many religions tend to reinforce this family structure, right? So it's a loop, right? So the family structure helps the people become religious, but then the religion ends up creating the family structure in the next generation. So you end up with things like, let's go back to the slides here, guys. This is a couple of slides taken from a faith-based charity initiative that's being done through a women's prison in New Mexico, and it ends up being kind of indoctrinating the women in this prison with these various things. And I'm just going to show some of the graphics that they have in this. And you can see here the four structures of authority. So this is religious indoctrination done in a women's prison, right? So we see here the four basic structures of authority. In business, the employer is the authority over the employees. That kind of makes sense. In a church, the religious leaders, the church leaders, have authority over the church members. That kind of makes sense. In the government, we have national leaders over local officials over the citizens. That kind of makes sense, right? We have a somewhat hierarchical government. And in the family, you see just this exactly the structure, the father over the mother over the children. And so here's another slide where you see this in a graphical format. God is over Christ, which is over the man, which is over the woman. And these cones extending down are the sort of spheres of authority. And you can see the woman has a smaller sphere of authority than the man. And so...
I thought Christ was God.
Yeah.
Obviously some heretic came up with this particular image.
Well, you see, God is a triangle here, so it must be a trinity, and Christ is just the bottom part of that.
Yeah, they're labeling the bottom line of that triangle.
So the relevant biblical quote is here is 1 Corinthians 11:3, which I actually have it handy.
Okay.
It's Paul talking.
Are you taking this from the Authorized version?
This is from the Skeptic's Annotated Bible.
That's even better.
Which I love. I think that's based on the King James, as I recall.
Yeah.
Although I'm
not sure if it's...
So, 1 Corinthians 11:3, but I would have you know that the head of every man is Christ, and the head of every woman is the man, and the head of Christ is God. So, that's more or less that last slide. So let's hear some Pat Robertson quotes along the same lines.
Yeah, the thing is that, and this is a sidebar to this, the next verse goes on to use that particular claim about
head coverings.
About to cover head coverings.
Yeah, so this is like goes on and on about head coverings.
Anybody who prays or prophesies with his head covered or without it, or with his head covered dishonors his head.
Which...
And any woman who does it
gets skipped over by these guys.
So women need to wear hats.
Yeah.
Lots and lots of hats.
Lots and lots of hats. So how about some fun Pat Robertson quotes along the same lines? I know this is painful for the ladies to hear, but if you get married, you have accepted the headship of a man, your husband. Christ is the head of the household, and the husband is the head of the wife, and that's the way it is, period. There's another one here. From Pat Robertson also, as long as the husband is following the mandate of the Lord, the wife should submit to his leadership, even though she may disagree with it. God's standard is true. Yet in many marriages, the wife is more able than her husband. Regretfully, a woman with great ability sometimes marries a man who does not have so much ability. This wife must resist the temptation to dominate her husband. Her husband will sometimes make decisions that the wife feels are wrong, but she must either gently persuade her husband or pray that God will change her husband's mind.
Yeah. The interesting thing is that if, you know, you're going to believe the Bible and the most common interpretations of the things that have been preached forever, and unless you do some really hard twisting and turning, Pat Robertson's exactly right. And to me, there are some liberal Christians who say, I'm not going to accept his interpretation. You start getting into the whole my interpretation, your interpretation, this is right, that's right.
So you see this authoritarianism more on the religious right side and not so much the liberal Christians, right? So there's a big disagreement there. Another example is the Promise Keepers, right? The Promise Keepers is this group of men who go and do the drum circles. No, I don't know what they do. They get together in these various... groups and things, and they, one of their tenets is that the husband needs to go home and dominate the wife. He needs to assert himself as the head of the household, and it's this very same sort of thing. So my point here is that authoritarianism and this religious right or this religion stuff ends up being reinforcing each other, right?
Right. So not only that, but it's the type of, I don't want to necessarily say that any authoritarian model is wrong. There may be certainly cases where it's correct, as I pointed out earlier, where from the child's point of view, they're still an authoritarian system, even when it's egalitarian. When they can see this compromise, they're still subject to the decisions of somebody else. And that's a good thing up to a certain age. One thing that this does, in addition to promoting the continuing propagation of religion and generating perhaps more bullies, is it generates victims. By training kids to accept authority figures, you're putting them in a position where when somebody comes along and tells them something and they seem to be in a position of authority, or they are in fact in a position of authority, they're more likely to just believe it. And the same is true for, you're not only setting up mindsets that are counterproductive or you know, cognitively dissonant, but victims for sexual predators, where the priest or whoever, and I don't want to blame it all on priests, but they can use their position of authority to attack these children who have been essentially trained to accept some level of authority over them, you know, in that sense. That's all I had.
Okay. Yeah, we had someone else in the audience comment that maybe in an egalitarian household, the children learn to play the parents against each other, and they might get smarter that way. learn how to you know, work the system that way. Whereas if the parents are got this hierarchy, maybe they can't work that quite so easily. So let me shift over now briefly and talk about authoritarianism in politics, and this is kind of what got me on this topic. There is this correlation. There is this funny correlation between this RWA, this right-wing authoritarianism personality. It doesn't tend to correlate with people who are Democratic, meaning that the Democratic Party ends up having kind of a whole spectrum of these types of people, whether they score high on this or score low on this. The Republican Party, the voters tend to be across the spectrum as well, but as you enter politics and as you get higher up in the politics, the more likely you are to score high on this RWA in the Republican Party. And part of this is because of the way these parties work. These type people tend to crawl to the top. They tend to get promoted within this. So it's interesting that there is this correlation with this RWA personality and Republican leadership. And of course, this makes this whole RWA scale very controversial because people think that, oh, well, this is just, you know, beating up on Republicans. This is party politics. And this Altemeyer has addressed this issue in his books. I should mention one of his books. His latest book is called The Authoritarians, which goes into this in great detail. I haven't read it, but I've heard good things about it. So that's something to look for. Bob Altemeyer. Okay. There's a couple other books that are very relevant to this lately. There is John Dean's book, Conservatives Without Conscience. John Dean is a kind of interesting guy. He was one of the bad guys in the Watergate scandal, but he ended up he was kind of a minor player in the Watergate scandal, but ended up being the star witness eventually. He ended up being the one who ratted out everybody else and sort of became something of a hero in the Watergate scandal because he helped resolve it. And he has commented, he's written a book called Conservatives Without a Conscience, which focuses on the present administration and the personalities of the various people in there and how so many of them are amoral. And we'll get to why that is in a little bit. There's also David Kuo's book called Tempting Faith. David Kuo was one of the faith-based initiative guys. I forget what the title of the group in under Bush was. Anyway, he was rather disappointed with how the faithful were treated by the administration. So both of these books are kind of pointing at the same thing, that the current administration seems to be using people, right? And maybe people who have genuine hopes for the Bush administration doing what they want and this whole political support thing. So I have some quotes here. So I'm reading from an article that John Dean wrote about David Kuo's book, where he's quoting Altemeyer. So it's very confusing, but all the quotes I'm going to be giving are Altemeyer's quotes. So what we have is we have Altemeyer says there are two types of authoritarians whom researchers can identified by answers to certain personality tests. There are people who become leaders in authoritarian movements, and there are their followers. So those are the two types. The leaders have a stronger drive for personal power, and they are also pretty amoral. Compared with most folks, they admit that when answering surveys anonymously, that manipulating others, exploiting the gullible, intimidating, cheating, and being a hypocrite are all justified if they get you what you want. They say that one of the best skills that a person can have can develop is the ability to look someone straight in the eye and lie convincingly. So this is the authoritarian leaders have this, you know, develop these skills. They say the world is full of suckers who deserve to be taken because they're so stupid. So apparently once you pull out of being a follower, you say, well, all these guys are suckers. I see that they're suckers. I'm going to take advantage of them. And so this is the type of people that tend to rise in these authoritarian regimes. And not surprisingly, you can go back to Hitler who said, what good fortune for those in power that people do not think. So that's a Hitler quote that kind of hits it on the head. I have a few more quotes and then we'll stop and take some calls. We get the numbers up. We're a live call-in show. This is December 3rd, right?
And yeah, if it's not December 3rd, don't pick
call
up the phone.
Don't call.
Because we're not here probably.
Okay, so conservative politicians are more likely to have this kind of personality than liberals are. Why? Because they usually have conservative economic and political beliefs, but more importantly, they head for the right because that's where the greatest majority of authoritarian followers are concentrated, looking for a leader. So when you have all these sheep sitting around, you're naturally going to attract people who are going to take advantage of those. So why do these authoritarians follow a moral and hypocritical and deceitful liars? So we've learned that we've got some leaders like Haggard, and we've got some leaders, political leaders like Tom DeLay, who are not trustworthy. Why do people follow them? And Altmaier says because one of their great vulnerabilities, which manipulative dominators exploit, is that authoritarian followers basically have copied the idea of the authoritarians in their lives. They haven't thought through about the things to any great degree and then decided what they believe in, so they just follow. To maintain their beliefs in a world of challenging discoveries and conflicting beliefs, they associate as much as possible with others who agree with them. They travel in small circles, getting booster shots of faith from one another. They rely on social support rather than evidence or logic to keep in believing, in many cases, what they've simply memorized. But this makes them quite vulnerable to manipulators who tell them what they want to hear. Experiments show that they're so glad to help find another person who will tell them that they are right that they don't consider the newcomer might have ulterior motives. All you have to do is get in their in-group, tell them that they are right even though you don't believe a word of it, and then since an in-group is made up of followers clinging to each other and looking for a leader, it's pretty easy for an unscrupulous person to take over, provided he can outmaneuver the other dominators trying to do the same thing. So the irony is that if the religious right has its way, the White House and Congress will be filled with amoral people. And he answers, yes, I am, although, of course, there would be exceptions. And I'd say the proof is already right in front of us. When did we ever have a president who insisted on having the right to torture people or a Congress who voted for it? How often have we had an administration deciding it could suspend habeas corpus and other constitutional guarantees and the Congress going along? And you see the amorality at the individual level. Look at the members of the House of Representatives who have been convicted of crimes lately. Or look at the list of 20 most corrupt members of the House compiled by the Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics. Every one of these lawmakers got high marks for their voting record from the James Dobson, Tony Perkins Family Research Council. That's not a coincidence. So the people who are endorsing these amoral leaders are the religious right here. The gullible rank and file don't realize this, but they send far more than their share of bribe-taking, influence-peddling, money-laundering, lying scoundrels to executive mansions and legislatures election after election. So we see the religion and we see this authoritarianism showing up in our politics now and with disastrous consequences, right? And so that's kind of what got me on this. So the whole religion and politics thing. I'm going to finish my little riff today with a little news piece. And when I read this news piece, you'll be amazed at how much insight that this previous little presentation will give you. This is from the Texas Eagle Forum. And this is about this Keith Ellison, who is a recently elected Democrat, who happens to be a Muslim. Okay? So Keith Ellison, the first Muslim elected to the United States Congress, this is from Minnesota, has announced that he will not take his oath of office from the Bible, but on the Bible of Islam, the Quran. He should not be allowed to do so, not because of any American hostility to the Quran, but because the act undermines American civilization. So we see this out-group thing.
Who's saying this?
This is the Texas Eagle Forum, which is one of the right-wing religious and political groups here in Texas, who, you know, more or less is the voice, one of the voices of the religious right here in Texas. First, it is an act of hubris that perfectly exemplifies multiculturalist activism. So this is their dirty word. My culture trumps American culture is what they're saying. What Ellison and his Muslim and leftist supporters are saying is that it's of no consequence what America holds to be its holiest book. All that matters is what any individual holds to be his holiest book. Forgive me, but America could not give a hoot about Keith Ellison's favorite book. Should not give a hoot about what Keith Ellison's favorite book is, insofar as the member of Congress taking an oath to serve America and upholding its values is concerned. America is interested in only one book, the Bible. If you are incapable of taking your oath on that book, don't serve in Congress.
I kind of almost agree with him on one point.
Yeah.
America shouldn't be concerned about what holy book this guy likes. We shouldn't give a damn what anybody likes. Whatever holy book you want to use. This hypocritical nonsense he's blathering on about how the Bible is America's favorite holy book. Well, you know what? American Idol is America's favorite show. Doesn't make it anything more than crap.
Right. So you see in this article, I'm going to stop reading from it, but you see in this article how the author is very much an authoritarian, very much is trying to put down this other religion, this rival religion, and using nationalism and using their love of their own holy book and such to do that.
And maintaining two contradictory notions in his head. One, that it's okay for me and all of everybody else in America to use the Bible as the holy book that we're on, but it's wrong for somebody else to use the Quran. This is, in addition to being the authoritarianism type of mentality, this is just another example of that myth of a Christian nation that gets pushed out, it seems like, nonstop.
Yep.
From, you know, all around. If you think America was founded based on the Bible and Christian principles, you really should go read something. You know, there was a great, the Mother Jones Diary magazine did a whole issue on separation church and state on the myth of a Christian nation, and it had a lot of great articles in there from some people who are much better with their words than I am. Mm-hmm. So that's one I'd
We're really big on church-state separation, and you can see that if you have an authoritarian church and authoritarian state, they can mesh with each other very well, right? That anybody who's not the, you know, God and country, right? They end up being interlocked, and they end up reinforcing each other very much at the expense of lots of other people who, you know, have differing beliefs or might be the wrong race or might be the wrong sex or might be the wrong sexual orientation or the wrong religion, whatever, right? And all these minorities end up suffering in these sorts of situations.
We talked about this before with regard to taking an oath when going into court. First of all, the entire notion of swearing to tell the truth is absurd. It doesn't make any difference what holy book you have them swear on the point is that you're taking an oath under penalty of perjury.
Right, that's what matters.
If you get up there and lie and we can demonstrate it, then you're going to go to jail.
You're bound to higher consequences if you lie.
It's the only binding force on your oath. It's
although it might scare some people into saying, well, you know, God will get me too if I lie.
Oh, that's the book my mom used to read me. I definitely better tell the truth now.
Let's take colors.